Welcome back to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy. We're talking about integrating technology in live legitimate theater, and my guest is Robert Matney, who is a web developer, an actor, and theater director. Robert, continue with what we were talking about, your current project.
We've got something exciting coming up. My partner Liz and I have been working in stealth mode and are just starting to come out of stealth mode on a project that we're working on that we expect to put up in the late spring. We've made some good progress on it, and this will, I think, really be the first time to talk publicly about it. And so that's exciting.
Great.
The piece that we're working on is, Liz and I are both interested in the interrogation of the relationship between audience and actor and how that evolves. This conversation is a broad one, and I think, you know, you get those smart folks who are doing the work with Sleep No More in New York, and they're, I think, leaders in a way of this conversation right now. And you get a lot of, I think it's very trendy right now to have immersive, interactive theater. And I think that that's a good, healthy place for theater to be going, and something that's rather important to me. It is the case, I think, that oftentimes it doesn't, whatever is the interactivity or the immersion doesn't necessarily arise organically from the work itself. And so it can feel quite bolt-on or gimmicky. This is not the case, I think, with Sleep No More, but I think it is the case with lots of pieces. And so Liz and I have been considering what an organic project that includes the audience's ability to govern the trajectory of the narrative would look like. What does it look like if you give control of the narrative to the audience and let them govern where it's going to go, and how do you manage that? And as Liz was doing her research, she had a eureka moment where she realized that the Oresteia, or the House of Atreus in Greek theater, as written by Sophocles, Aeschylus, etc., create a kind of multiverse of a particular narrative where you have a whole bunch of different narrative possibilities all surrounding the same characters, because these different playwrights had their own take on these same kinds of family relationships. So that natively, if you survey the canon of that literature, you get all of these variables that are kind of already written for us. Additionally, the narrative tropes of Greek theater include as one of its primary features, and especially in the House of Atreus pieces, moments where new information comes to the characters from, as it were, outside the world of the play, in the shape of oracles from the gods. So, you know, they go to the oracle, you know, does some sort of ecstatic dance and brings back a prophecy from the god, and then the character engages with that prophecy. So here you've got two valuable things in terms of an audience-controlled narrative, which is an already written set of variable possibilities of narrative, one, and two, a trope where information is coming in from outside of the world of the play. And so what we've done is create, well, if you imagine like a sports playoffs grid, of course, in that context, the progress goes from at the edge of the grid into the middle, where the champion is the one that survives, right? But if you invert that and you imagine that you've got a narrative that starts as one possibility but then branches out into two possibilities and then branches out to two again and then branches out to three from there, you get a grid that reflects 12 possible narratives that branch at three specific inflection points, moments where the narrative takes a left or a right, or in the third inflection point, a left, a center, or a right. So what we've done is grid out a complete set of these narratives out to 12 and have created a way within the narrative where at the top of the play, Zeus basically will descend resplendent as the god that he is. And then after a couple of lines, tired both of that moment and his own history, says, you know what, screw it. I'm not going to play god anymore. In fact, you guys are going to do it. Good luck. And drops the mic and walks off, right? At that moment, then the audience is briefly trained on how they're going to control the trajectory of the narrative. And from that point on, at predefined moments, a character goes to the oracle, and then the audience is going to have 20 seconds to vote on a set of prophecies. And the winner is the prophecy that in that moment will get communicated back to the character. And that will then govern the new trajectory of the play. So, you know, there's an analogy to be made with a choose your own adventure. There's an analogy to be made with a number of variable ending pieces like the Mystery of Edwin Drood. So there is some precedent in theater for this kind of choose an ending. In this case, however, we're talking about a fundamental new trajectory of the narrative at three specific moments, variably controlled by our audience. And we'll use digital inputs for this. And we're very much in the exploration stage of what that technology is going to look like. We want to make sure that we're attending to that digital divide I referenced earlier, where we're not punishing people just because for whatever reason they don't have a smartphone. So we're trying to find a way that includes an app on your phone, but then also includes an alternative way of putting in that data. So that's the project that we're working on right now. We've got we're in early talks with Fusebox Festival to let this be part of what kicks off their incubator series. And we're looking to a workshop at the end of spring 2014 and then a full production in the early summer of 2015.
So, Robert, who else is involved in Austin with your projects?
So I work a lot with Beth Burns, who's the artistic director of Hidden Room Theater, and her imagination has really been a touchstone for a lot of this work. She will tell you quickly that she's not technologically proficient, and yet such a vibrant imagination that it's a great partnership to work with her, and we feed off of each other. I also have the good fortune to work a lot with Graham Schmidt and Breaking String Theater, where we haven't done any digital interactive theater specifically. We have done an awful lot of live streaming of productions and a little bit of innovative work around the website and how to connect with online communities. And then in this next project, I'm working closely with my spouse, Liz Fisher. And I would say that in this space, that's the group that's really doing this work. The Rude Mechanicals are always doing innovative work in town. And one of their recent pieces, I think, has real potential for technical implementation, and I think they may be heading in that direction. They're certainly well in the direction of quality immersive work. And so though I've not collaborated with them, I feel like they're a little bit of a player in this space, and I think probably will become more of a player in this space.
I just did an interview with Graham Schmidt.
Graham is just so dang clever.
He is. I mean, it's fascinating. We talked about his choice of new Russian plays, which I thought was fantastic, and to bring that to a new audience, an American audience.
Yeah, he and I teamwork in that way, and I feel really fortunate to get to have that relationship with him. And I really, you know, his work is so primed for this kind of effort because of the fundamentally international nature of it. And so I think, you know, we've done a lot of work bringing the communities together. I'm hoping that he and I will be able to collaborate to create something that is actually transacted online. And so that we've had some early conversations about it. I don't yet know where it's going to go, but I always like working with Graham.
Yeah, he seems like a good guy. And like you said, bringing international peace is just wonderful. And speaking of internationals, your involvement with the Center for International Theater Development. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Philip Arnault came into my world through Graham Schmidt. It's been really fruitful to get to know Philip and learn some of what he knows. And of course, so much of what he knows is how to bring international communities together and engage them and build relationships. And that's been a real gift.
Philip, yeah. I've known Philip for quite a long time, probably about 30 years or so. And I worked for him at Baltimore Theater Project, which he founded in 72. And then he started the Center for International Theater Development. What was your first involvement with Philip in this?
Philip came to the New Russian Drama Festival. That was my first interaction with him that Breaking String produced. And that was one of the festivals that I helped Graham produce. And so that was the first connection. And he brought some of the folks that were part of his project to translate a whole load of great new Russian plays into English. And so really it was just around enjoying Russian theater and building relationships that included people that he was very well connected to.
And so tell me about the projects that you've been involved with in the center.
Yeah, well, so, you know, one of the things that your audience may know that Philip has done is this Beyond the Capitals program. And in this program, Philip brought a whole crew of talented, energetic theater artists from across Russia, some from Moscow, some from St. Petersburg, some from Yekaterinburg, and some from Omsk, Siberia, and brought them on a tour through a few cities in the U.S. that were also beyond the capitals. And those cities included Baltimore, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Austin. And he brought them with a focus on meeting who he felt were promising peers in these various cities, promising in terms of promising that a good relationship will emerge from it. So I got to be one of the presenters in Austin to this cohort of Russian artists. And I presented on digital interactive theater and talked about, my work and our work here in the city. And so did a bunch of other Austin artists. And that went for all of the cities. And so when Philip was looking to generate the reciprocal plan, a plan where a group of artists from the U.S., those same cities, would then do a trip to Russia. He and I talked about the capacity to build out an online platform that would enable the people who can't go on that trip with us to participate as much as possible. And so I worked with Philip and Susan Stroop, who was then also at the Center for International Theater Development, to build procedures and protocols for how to share what they were doing back out to the public. And so, you know, we set up things like Twitter feeds and Facebook groups and developed a website that would be easy for them to update as they go from city to city and from experience to experience. But I also trained them in how to do live streaming for key events so that they could share those publicly. And that trip happened in May. I was not able to go on that trip. However, there is going to be a sequel wherein the traveling cohorts from Russia and the U.S. will gather about a year from now, roughly, I think, is the date that they're planning on now, to process it, to talk about collaborations. And for that, I'll be on the ground with them, and I will get the opportunity to oversee that online community building.
A lot of my programs, I like to implement sort of a blueprint or a business plan in developing, which would be developing the theme, the interaction with people, developing what we want to do with it, and then visiting again 3 months, 6 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years down the road, because it's really basically a living thing. How do you see this happening in 3 months, 6 months? What do you see that you hope will happen in this term?
Yeah, you know, I think that live streaming is becoming technologically trivial. So I think we're getting to a point where lay people can, with quite a lot of ease, live stream their work. And I think that this is an important step in broad uptake. So I think we're going to see the needle move on that in the next 3 to 6 months. Some of that work has been led by New Play TV. So the folks who run New Play TV have been doing a great job of stewarding a live stream channel that they allow different theaters to utilize to live stream to their public. I will say that I'm hoping that over the next 3 to 6 months, we're going to see more practitioners be less reticent to embrace network technology. So that's a hope. I'm not all that confident about it, but I'm going to do everything I can to advocate for it. In terms of beyond 6 months, I think the biggest movement is going to be in wearable computing. I mean, we're going to see the next generation of Google Glass and the various competitors who have been flying in stealth mode but are about to come out of stealth mode. I think we're going to see that move a lot. And once one of the key elements in success of digital interactive theater is, if you will, the frictionlessness of the interaction. So the more that we can make going to the technology without friction, the more it is going to fit simply into the act of theater. And the more our computing is wearable, the less friction it produces. You know, when a simple move of your pupil is going to be a data input, then you can collect data input from your audiences without having to stop and say, now we collect your data input. So I think the biggest movement we're going to see over the next year is the new possibilities that are revealed by wearable computing.
Well, one of the things that just hit me when you were saying that is that it can't be prohibitive. One of the actors approaches you and involves you and makes you uncomfortable. So it could border on that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's always the issue. I think it's one of the boundaries that gets moved, you know, back and forth right now, especially as different companies have their take on how to challenge the relationship between audience and actor. It is my commitment that that theater should be entirely consensual, and that you should never create a pressure moment to force an audience member to participate in a way that might make them uncomfortable. There's a special power, I think, that a performance has over an audience member to get them to do a thing they will later regret. And I feel like that is fundamentally retrograde to good ethics. And so I think that anyone in this work should be very, very careful about how they enlist the audience in ensuring that there's a way of declaring consensuality and a way of crying uncle. Absolutely, I think that's important.
Yeah, that has to be seriously addressed, because that's a fine line. There are things you can do, but there are things that you can, even unaware, go over that line, and then people will just be turned off about it. And that, you know, like Twitter, will spread too. You don't want that to be one of the causes for this to really not pick up with other people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that is definitely part of that frictionlessness. How do you make it happen without requiring that people make a spectacle of themselves that they may not want to make? And I think that, you know, that asks a slightly further question. Can you enable the ability for some people to make a spectacle of themselves in a way that works within the narrative while still also allowing others to not choose that? And where do you draw that line? And I think it's an interesting question. For me, I just don't force it on anybody. If you want to participate, it's because you want to. And you know the score before it begins, and so you know what you're getting into. So consensuality seems essential to me in our work.
If you dare, you like to talk about, and I won't hold you to it, say a year, 5 years down the road?
5 years down the road. You know,
I know things change as we're talking right now, so say right. 5 years down the road. But just in terms of the connection between technology and theater.
Yeah. Well, you know, I missed an obvious one, another place where the needle's going to move. I mean, so I say, you know, in a year we're going to have new possibilities revealed to us by wearable computing, but that wearable computing isn't going to be affordable by any meaningful standard, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, across 5 years, we're going to see those prices drop so that's what has been revealed is actually accessible. And so that's one thing. But there's another huge one, and that is simple. Network bandwidth. You know, how much data can your pipeline handle?
Right.
And at the end of the day, this thing lives and dies by bandwidth. And so, you know, Google Fiber is going to move that needle partly. As your audience may already know, AT&T has kind of raised their war flags against Google Fiber. This is part of where they're choosing to fight a commercial battle, which is to say, actually, we can get to you quicker than Google can with gigabit fiber, where gigabit fiber just means a whole mess of data, something like 100 times what most people are used to. And so things are going to live and die by bandwidth capacity. Things are going to live and die by wearable computing. Both of those are going to proliferate extraordinarily over the next 5 years, so much so that it's impossible to predict what that landscape's going to look like in 5 years.
Visiting back to just 3 months or 6 months, what do you think that we can do, Baltimore Internet Radio and you and any other of the people, like-minded people who want to be involved? What can we do? I'd be happy to do a ton of more programs, involve anybody we can. But what's your feeling on that?
Yeah, good. I mean, I think the most important thing is building collaborative relationships, building a community around the idea of integration of technology, and helping connect people who are interested, because any new field is going to require smart brains talking to each other, bouncing ideas off of each other, and really growing together. So I think the most important thing is building a community around it. So whatever Baltimore radio can do, internet radio can do to build community, I think is useful. I think that there wants to be some kind of meetup / conference on the topic at some point in the next year or so. And I'd love to see that happen. I'm not sure who would do that, but I'd love to see it happen. Building collaborative relationships in terms of helping people actually do work together, so not just bounce ideas off of each other, but actually transact theater across the internet. But I would say the most important thing is to destigmatize technological integrations into theater. For the voices, and I hear them so often, for the voices that say you're robbing theater of what's essential by integrating technology, to say, how do we keep what's essential? Don't frame the question in terms of, you are taking away what's essential, but rather in terms of a challenge, which is, how do we retain what's essential as we move into a digital world? Because we are, whether we like it or not, we're going into an increasingly digital world. So the question is, how do we keep theater alive in it? And the people who are most in love with what's essential about theater have the most responsibility to show up and ensure that what they understand is essential and what they love is mapped onto this new work. So really, I think it's a social shift.
Well, I think the foundation of the, well, we won't say naysayers, but the people that are, wondering about it, is that it's kind of scary, really. I mean, we live in a world where it seems like everything that we do and say is recorded.
Yeah.
So we're thinking, well, I don't want to look bad, or I don't want this to look bad, my work, and all this kind of, thinking, possibly, is maybe that's what preventing people from joining it right away.
No, I think that's right. But I would just say that in the same way that there are new social web tools that eliminate the ability to go back to it, to record across the long term. So, for example, I'm thinking of this Vine that was recently acquired by Twitter, Vine tool. You can only view that once. So there is a ephemerality to it. If we agree that part of what's essential about theater is its ephemerality, which I think is a fair assertion, then the question is, how do we retain ephemerality for this?
Right.
And there are ways to retain ephemerality. You can force that data to be deleted. And so that's what I mean by we need those Luddites at the table to say, yeah, but then it's recorded, so that others can say, aha, but it doesn't have to be recorded. How can we do this and prevent it from being recorded? And so I think you're right. There's a whole lot of fear. And for most of those fears, there's a really efficient way to address it and make meaningful that input.
I'm just thinking in terms of age groups.
And that is
that you get the, what do they call it, the 18 to 49ers are more readily acceptable of something like this, and people older than that, which is my age, it might be a little harder to do. Those might be the people that really go to theater, too.
No, that's great. It's such a good point. So, I mean, clearly there's generational issues embedded into it. And I think that has a lot to do with that social shift of diminishing the fear factor of it. I mean, on the one hand, the practitioners need to be sensitive to the whole audience, to the whole age and socioeconomic spectrum as well, you know, is just to the whole audience. And that means allowing inclusion, encouraging inclusion, and being alert to what's going to worry people. And I would say that also there's a responsibility across generations to not get too crystallized into your own expectations. One of the most technologically proficient people I know is a woman named Sherry Lowry, who's got 20 years on you easy, Dave. And she was an early adopter of Twitter and an early adopter of darn near everything else. And she just masters it. Well, okay, not everyone can be Sherry Lowry, but I think the responsibility goes in both directions. How do we keep ourselves willing to learn new things throughout life? And then as heartful and passionate artists, how do we ensure that we're enabling access for the entire audience?
On the other hand, what's happening in theater, I think, in my lifetime, has always been exciting. I lived the last 10 years in Europe, what's happening over there in terms of site-specific theater. And what this could do to enhance that is just incalculable, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. Yeah. Yeah, I think it really I think it really is in line with the mission of people who are you know, untethering theater from traditional venues. There's this marvelous theater festival called the Anywhere Theater Festival in Brisbane, I think it's headquartered out of. And we had a chance to talk early on with them, and the whole thing is, you want to be a part of this festival, you just have to do your work outside of a traditional theater. Well, you know, digitally is way outside of a traditional theater, and it really encourages a different way of considering our spaces and how we perform and where we perform. So I think that non-traditional venues are an essential piece of this work, and just pragmatically, one of the reasons why is cost. You know, once you can be more flexible with where you do your work, you can control for your expenses much more successfully.
Bringing international theater to a local audience, could you imagine theater companies in Serbia or Lebanon being able to, you know, perform, and people in Austin and Baltimore to see it in real time, and also archive to see it whenever they want to? I mean, there's always going to be the language barrier. And in Baltimore Theater Project, we did a lot of plays that were just visual. They didn't have spoken word in them. And they were amazing stuff. I mean, we got audiences from all over, from all age groups that really loved the stuff. And I think, you know, to bring in that more, for lack of a better word, avant-garde theater would be very impressive too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we see the success of these programs with the Royal National and the Globe in the UK doing streams of their work to cinemas. And we see that. And clearly it's got a lot to teach us in terms of providing more accessibility. What it necessarily doesn't do so far is provide real interactivity. You know, I mean, one of the things we love about theater is the danger of it. At some point, someone might sneeze obnoxiously. They might have a stroke. This may go up on their line. There's a very, you know, it's interactive in all directions, and that gives it a danger that we, I think, are craving. It's what we want when we go to the theater instead of cinema, or at least it's one of the things. And so I think accessibility is a piece, and that vision of accessibility, I think, should extend beyond making sure that avant-garde theater can make it into places where it would not have previously made it, but go into building relationships between the avant-garde artists and the people in that unexpected location. And I know this comment may sound a little bit trite and or pap, and yet, having grown up in the shadow of the Cold War and believing that for a period that the Russians were my enemies, I feel like there is something fundamental about the value of just being able to work with and interact with people all over the world. It is much harder to buy into the fictions of political adversity when, in fact, you're going to share a coffee and figure out how the play is going to work.
Exactly. I mean, basically, it's a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's finding out what the other guy thinks. So we seem to be very provincial here in the States. Like, the whole world revolves around here, and there is so much out there that I think this will include it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I you know, it's a big statement, but I actually think this kind of work is good for world peace. I actually believe that.
I think so. You don't sound like you're writing for Miss America. It is true. I think so, too. You know, I think that is a great step. I mean, it's a lot better than what's happening now, I think. But we won't go into that. But so you're excited. I'm excited. We're going to continue this. Is there anything you want to add?
No, we've covered it. What a delightful conversation, Dave. I'm so glad you had me on. I don't know what else I'd add other than gratitude.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Is there any kind of contact info you would like to give the
Sure, yeah.
Listeners?
Folks can reach me on Twitter at R Matney, R-M-A-T-N-E-Y. That's at R-M-A-T-N-E-Y. And then you can also catch my blog, if you're interested, at rmatney.wordpress.com.
And I also put some links on my website, too. Robert, it's been terrific talking to you. I want to continue this
and
see how it evolves and get other people involved in it and, you know, talk it up and do it like a business plan. We visit it in 3 months and see what works and what doesn't, throw out what doesn't, and work on the stuff that is positive. What do you say?
I look forward to that conversation, David. I look forward to all of them. It's great.
I've been talking with Robert Matney of Austin, Texas, a web developer who is into integrating technology in live legitimate theater. I will give you all his info on the website. You can contact him, and let's keep this together. Let's keep it going. And because, like Robert, like you said, it is the future, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We have no choice.
Embrace it. It's
yes,
coming.
Exactly. It's not scary. You know, even for us oldsters. Thank you again, Robert, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Good. Take care.
Bye-bye.